OTB
AM. Thanks to Screwfix.ie. Championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.
A very good morning to you. Welcome along to Monday morning's OTB AM. And we're here to luxuriate in our first ever victory against the All Blacks in Dublin anyway. It's our second victory, clearly, but it's the first time that we've done it on home soil. We're going to speak with Alan Quinlan, going to speak with Gregor Paul a little bit later on to get the view from the New Zealand media. And of course, we're going to share your thoughts about the weekend too. So hit us up with your comments on Twitter at Off The Ball. You can also leave a comment for us. We're streaming live on Facebook.com/Off The Ball or on YouTube.com/Off The Ball. Oh, and you were at the game.
I was. Yeah. It was great.
This makes up for you missing Chicago, right?
Well, 100%, because this was a better win than Chicago, as we've all been instructed over the last couple of days, which it was. Like, it is more important when it's in front of your home fans. There was less excuses from a New Zealand standpoint.
No excuses. They have no excuses. It was like, your two second rows, they were both playing. You had your full first choice team. You had like World Player of the Year nominee at out half, kick and drop goals, doing all the things that, you know, you can't do. Mm. But we still killed you.
Yeah.
Except with the bit which hasn't really been spoken about, where we kicked the ball back to them with like a minute left on the clock. Why did we do that?
Joey Carberry is why we did that, apparently. Luke McGrath was saying that after the game, that it was his call. And I was actually quite surprised to hear that. I was like, well, fair play to you to actually go in there and make that big a call when you're into the kind of white heat of battle like that. Granted, I suppose, as an out-half, you kind of have to be kind of calling in-game as to what your tactical approach is going to be. But McGrath said, yeah, Joey said that it's time for a box kick.
Right.
And the collective groan around the Aviva resulted. And immediately, within about 30 seconds, it probably gained beyond the point where the box kick had actually come from. So it seemed to be totally futile. But I guess that just kind of feeds into this utter confidence that the side have, that if that's what they were going to do in the 13th minute of the match, to clear their lines, well, they're going to stick to the same thing in the 79th minute. And whether or not that's actually a smart thing to do, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind just kind of like taking away the heat from the conversation and asking, what is the strategy behind that, kicking the ball to the All Blacks in the last minute of the game? Because they've got a little bit of history in the last minute of the game, at Lansdowne Road in particular.
Well, maybe we don't care about the history of the All Blacks. Maybe we genuinely see them as a team that are a very, very good rugby team, probably still the best team in the world. And we're going toe-to-toe to them. Who cares about the history that they've caused us a lot of pain? Because that would, first of all, have been done to weaker Irish teams than us and possibly by better All Blacks teams. So all that matters is the here and now. And we are going to put our foot down. And it's going to be our game that we're going to play here. And that feeds into the whole idea of superiority that we should be feeling right now.
Yeah.
Forget this whole idea that, oh, we've peaked too soon or we've got the All Blacks angry. Of course you want to get them angry. We want to make the world angry. We want to stamp our foot of fury on the world of rugby right now. And I think we should enjoy this crest of a wave that we're all riding right now.
Well, we all remember the All Blacks were flaky until they won the World Cup. But they had to have the rules changed. They had to have, like, you know, no penalties given against them in the final 15 minutes the first time. And then obviously they had the greatest team of all time with two of the best players at 7 and 10 that have ever played the game. But they've retired. So maybe flaky New Zealand is back.
Yeah, and at 10 now they have a two-time World Rugby Player of the Year. He's no good, is he? Well, if you're really clinging on to something to try and signify that maybe the All Blacks weren't at it, I wonder, is it that smile after Beauden Barrett hits that drop goal? Was there kind of an element that, oh God, these guys are just playing around with us, or they're just toying with Ireland. He's kicking drop goals for fun now on the penalty advantage. That's the one thing you could perhaps cling to. The naysayers this morning could perhaps cling to that.
Well, there,
the All Blacks were just joking around.
This is rope-a-dope.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, let's let Paddy win this one. You know, get ahead of themselves and come crashing down in the World Cup quarterfinal. I mean, it'll probably be the Springboks knocking them off anyway.
Yeah. I've got a sneaking suspicion that the Springboks could knock the All Blacks off in the first game of the World Cup, and it will be an Ireland All Blacks quarterfinal rematch, which will be quite something. Better to get them early than later on in the tournament, I would say.
We play the next day against Scotland. So that first game,
it's like the second day of the tournament, isn't it?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. So do you throw that game then and go, look, we'll come through the back door and play the Springboks?
Well, the thing is, if you're going to throw a game against Scotland, then you go in against a home nation. And like, I'm not going to say it's a game that we have a big chance of losing at all. But you're putting yourself on the back foot immediately. Okay, it's fascinating that we're talking about actually negotiating the World Cup here by going through the back door, by going in as second seed to win the World Cup, because it's already too easy doing it as top of our pool.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're clearly the best team in the world. So coming up, we're going to bring you through the sports pages. Alan Quinlan's going to join us around about 8 o'clock, and we're going to talk with him. We're going to also get the reaction from New Zealand, McGregor Paul from the New Zealand Herald. We'll run you through the rest of the day's sports news. And then Nathan is in Aarhus in Denmark, because there's a game on tonight, which most people have forgotten about. It's Ireland against Denmark, and it's kind of important in terms of our seeding for the European Championships. Of course, one of those games in the European Championships will be held in the same stadium that was rocking on Saturday, and wouldn't it be nice to have a major tournament home match in that stadium with a team that was, you know, good enough to justify their existence. Time for the papers.
OTB AM.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.
So there is the Independent, a wraparound world at their feet is Johnny Sexton smiling through the guard of honour given by the All Blacks on the front when Ireland beat the All Blacks is the picture of Sexton as well, where he's just tackled somebody into touch. I think there's about 5 minutes left to go in the game, and it is a great picture. He's absolutely manic intensity, I think, in the words of Paul O'Connell. Also a wraparound on the Irish Times sports section there. So touchdown to history. It's the overhead camera of Jacob Stockdale sliding in after one of the greatest moves in the history of Irish rugby. Our first win in Twickenham in, was it 04? Was it 04 we go to Twickenham and win? And Gervin Dempsey scores, and it's a beautiful, clearly pre-programmed move, like the absolute apex of Eddie O'Sullivan's career. Like, this was right up there with that. Like, that, in terms of moments in Irish rugby, is winning away at Twickenham against the defending World Cup champions. That was pretty special. This is exactly of the same magnitude. But the bit where Bundy just cuts back and, man, what's going on here? Mm. What are they doing? And then for Stockdale to execute from that point, a perfectly weighted kick that bounces just the right, that gives him enough time just to sneak between the two, that he's got enough power and momentum and size to slide over even though he's actually been tackled.
Yeah.
It's ludicrous.
It's
a ludicrous piece of skill.
It really is. And athleticism, and just seeing Stockdale outrun a number of All Blacks to get that ball and touch it down properly was just fantastic. It was, I don't know, like you talk about that Bundy move there, I didn't even quite realise what he had done. And Sexton was involved in the build-up as well until Andy Dunn and Malcolm O'Kelly were sitting in here yesterday and describing exactly the minute detail that Joe Schmidt would have had to go to actually get that move off, and the amount of practice and the amount of time at the training ground it would have gone in. And it is just that level of attention to detail allied with the beast that is Jacob Stockdale and his capabilities of executing something like that, which just makes it such an exhilarating team to watch.
Yeah. Stockdale, remember, like, nowhere near this Ireland team effectively a year ago. Like, people are like, oh, he might be good. Might get a run here and there. 12 tries, 14 games. Thanks very much. Record-breaking pace at the moment. So the Times Ireland edition here. Family key in Schmidt, future call. Can't really have nice things last for too long in Ireland, can we? It's like immediately we need to start worrying the anxiety of who will be the next Ireland coach after Joe Schmidt leaves, after the World Cup. You know, after he's won the World Cup for us, obviously. An amazing moment pre-game where Steve Hansen walks up and gives an envelope to Joe Schmidt.
Yeah, 750 quid.
Yeah, for tickets. It's like the two rugby unions, maybe, you know, like, no. Somewhere along the way, something has happened where, come on, give the manager of the opposition some tickets.
Yeah, no.
Or let New Zealand Rugby Football Union should be paying for that. Like, come on.
Or maybe not. Maybe just keep them out. Maybe just give ourselves every single advantage. Those four dissenting voices against the Irish would have stopped them winning on Saturday night.
The front is also a rugby picture of the Times Ireland edition, but it's a picture of Beavan Parsons, who's 16, who became Ireland's youngest senior debutante when she played against the full USA team. Ireland were beaten 19-10 in Donnybrook at the weekend. Beavan Parsons, 16, coming off the bench. And Kieran Kennedy has a story in the back of the Times saying that the head coach is not concerned about, it's a step up. I mean, over the last 2 months, she's been able to experience a taste of senior women's rugby in our camps. She's not allowed to play in the AIL until she's 18, but she is allowed to play in senior international rugby because they don't have a rule preventing you from playing at 16. Not a great sign for the depth of Irish rugby when we're putting 16-year-olds in to play senior internationals in a sport like rugby where, you know, it's pretty physical. It's possible for significant injury to happen. So you just hope that everything is going to be okay for her. And congratulations to her, obviously. So New Heights, why the world is talking about Irish rugby, pages 2-9 in the Examiner. It's a great picture of Peter Mahoney. Mahoney generally has been given 10 by everybody. And there's the back page picture is the bench celebrating in full time. And Peter Mahoney barely able to get out of the seat because he's like completely dead at that stage. Apparently he had a dead leg in the first half. And they were worried at halftime, so he kind of had to keep moving at halftime to get him back out in the field for the second half.
Yeah, it was a Rambo performance from him, wasn't it? It was just, he was like looking for punishment, taking everything that they could possibly give him. And he was like, nah, it's all fine. The one thing that did finally floor him was that celebration at the end. Who would have thought it, that a knock-on from Brodie Retallick was going to be the final nail in the coffin of Peter O'Mahony's body on Saturday night? It was an absolutely outrageous performance. I wonder if that back row as a unit, if that performance we saw on Saturday night was the best ever back row performance we've seen from an Ireland team.
I mean, it's right there, yeah.
When you think about it, all three were absolutely ridiculous.
So when we beat Australia in the World Cup, and we had Stephen Ferris, Sean O'Brien, Jimmy Heaslip.
That was famously an outstanding night for Irish back rows.
And it's hard. We're picking nits here, but one of those back rows might be slightly ahead of the other one.
Well, let's just say there was no legendary scrum half getting picked up and thrown back 400 yards on Saturday night. But everything bar that came pretty close. And also you had the hit on Retallick. That was Toner, really,
yeah,
who actually drove
it. Toner
and
Ryan, yeah. But this All Blacks team better than that Australia team.
True.
No, maybe not. Maybe that Australia team is pretty good. Blank of Ireland. See what they did there? O'Neill's men lack goal-scoring threat, says the Racing Post in Captain Obvious headline of the day. And then Fahim Floored, the machine fails to fire, stablemate Sharjah sweeps by to land Morgiana.
Onto the tabloids, the back page of the Irish Daily Star this morning is Pressure My Aarhus. O'Neill says he is focused on victory. Excellent stuff from the Irish Daily Star this morning. Tabitha morning to you indeed. And IRFU sweat on Schmidt decision. Back of the Sun this morning is We'll Answer Ireland's Call. Seamus sure boys in green can scrum good. It's just all the rugby soccer comparisons. It's just like a handful of salt. Just looking for the wound in the Irish football fraternity and just scrubbing it right in deep this morning. That's what this is. I don't see anything wrong with comparisons. People are like, well, we shouldn't be comparing, but maybe we should take a look at something that, you know, where you can achieve excellence with a comparatively smallish pool of players and things like that. So I don't know. Let's strive for the greatness the rugby team are producing consistently at the moment. Back page of the Herald is, this is all my fault. O'Neill admits pressure on to lift side. It's Denmark against Ireland tonight in the Nations League. Back page of the Mirror then is New Zell. O'Neill's troops energised by Ireland rugby heroes, and Skipper Coleman says team are inspired. And don't worry, it's not Go Schmidt. Joe Schmidt has hinted that Ireland's latest triumph over the All Blacks will not affect his pending decision on whether or not to stay. Decision is made, says the back of the Irish Daily Mail. Schmidt knows his future, but is set to make Ireland fans wait for a fortnight. And then a couple of the UK back pages. The Telegraph leads with Harry Kane. World's best Kane fires England to finals as England come from behind to beat Croatia 2-1. And slide and deliver. Kane strikes late to seal spot in Nations League finals.
Yeah, not a bad headline. Slide and deliver at the end for Harry Kane. So a quick look at the Irish news for you before we get to Alan Quinlan. So 3-goal O'Boyle crushes Cross to book final spot. A first half hat-trick for Guidor in the game against Cross. Pretty much put that Ulster semi-final to bed, and cold wind blowing for under fire Republic boss. Is it possible this is Martin O'Neill's last game? Very possible that this is Martin O'Neill's last game, especially because badly, although paying them off might not be something that the FAI have the capability of doing at the moment. Right, let's go back to the rugby. Alan Quinlan is standing outside. He's going to be in 2 seconds. First, let's bring you the thoughts of Malcolm O'Kelly here in studio yesterday talking about Rory Best's performance against the All Blacks.
Where do you think, I mean, you're asking yourself as a line-out tactician, did Dev get the ball thrown to O'Mahony more often than himself on purpose? Do you think that was,
Yeah, well, I think he was either, without giving away Rory's skill and technique, the key to to Dev is getting up in front of the guy. So he's got to be able to either his movement get up in the air, and Rory has the ball in before they can get it up.
What do you mean?
Too much movement on the ground.
Yeah.
And try to go behind a player, and then you're going to be in trouble.
What do you mean? Not giving away Rory's.
Well, Rory's a certain style of throw.
Go on.
You know, I won't. No, I won't.
This is common knowledge.
Well, all you have to do is watch the tapes.
Okay, well then you watch the tape and now give me a sense. You don't have to give away everything, but just give me a clue.
Well,
what are you talking about?
It's very direct, let's say. Whereas
there's not much of an arc on
it. There's not much of an arc or any of that kind of thing. But he does. But the brilliant thing about it is that he doesn't have any movement in his arms. So he holds that ball straight above his head.
Yeah.
So if you're a jumper and you're defending, you can't watch him. It's pointless watching him because the ball is in. So you have to completely rely on watching the jumper.
Mm.
The jumper will always beat you.
There's no trigger.
Whereas if you were watching a hooker, say like a Shane Byrne would have a big wind up and let go. So you'd know when you knew you have a second or two to get up in the air.
You could almost judge the rhythm of Byrne's throw.
Yeah,
whereas
exactly.
Best doesn't have that same rhythm.
It's just the ball's in.
Okay,
you know, like it's almost like just finger. Like he uses his fingers to throw the ball.
Now that wasn't that hard, was it?
No, it wasn't. No.
All right, Alan Quinlan is here. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks, Ger.
Where does that rank?
That's the best, no doubt about it. I think it's the best result, best win we've ever had. What a year it's been for Irish rugby. You know, 2018 Grand Slam, winning in Australia. And beating New Zealand with missing Conor Murray, Robbie Henshaw, Dan Levy, Sean O'Brien. It's right up there. I thought it was incredible performance. I was surprised because, you know, to go from where they were last week against Argentina, which in some senses it was a perfect performance. I said that, to get it up to that level. And it's Joe Schmidt masterplan.
Yeah, did we do a little bit of rope-a-dope ourselves? It was like, tell you what, lads, just be very soft around the fringes. Let them come at us up the centre, and we'll put some bad film on tape that the All Blacks will be like, that's easy. That's going to be no problem for us, because it was chalk and cheese. The difference.
It was a mental thing. You know what I mean? The level of intensity and the adrenaline, the energy that the team had at the weekend was off the Richter scale. You know, and it was hard to get to that level. And emotion in rugby is very important. And it's very hard to have that high emotion every week. It's not feasible at times. And that's when you hear about grinding out results and doing the basics well and staying, you know, resilient and stuff like that. But it was through the roof on Saturday. And the intriguing part for me was they expected to win.
Yeah.
Maybe we didn't all expect it. You know, and that's understandable. It's a nervousness about, you know, New Zealand are going to be better after the English game and loads of stuff has to go right for us, and we get a little bit of luck at times, but I thought we should have been further ahead at half time. I thought the lack of panic was incredible, even though it wasn't good for the supporters or people watching, like, because sometimes we kicked the ball away and our kicking game was poor, a couple of lineouts that were really crucial. So I guarantee you, Josh Middle will look back at the game and he'll point out a load of things that should have been better.
Yeah.
But I thought the effort level. And in my own position as a back row, I'm a bit biased towards back rows because I think they can influence games, win, lose. They've so many involvements in games. I thought our back row on Saturday they were so immense. O'Mahony, Stander, and Josh van der Fleer, who was, you know, they were sensational as a unit and they really got in their faces and they set a real tone from that turnover early on when New Zealand had that pressure on. Where Stander and Van der Fleer get the turnover. You can see the reaction in the crowd. It gives energy to the players. So there's a lot of big moments. But I spoke to Keane Healy after the game and I told him, cheer up a little bit. You're just after beating New Zealand. It's the second time in 113 years. And he was there. We expected to win. I don't think he'll mind me saying that. And that's not an insult. He genuinely believed that, you know, that they're good enough to win these games now. If we were playing New Zealand next Saturday, would we back it up? I think we would. Like, there might be a break in play, but it'd be really intriguing. And that scenario happens in the tests, you know, and in the tour matches where you play two or three matches. In 2012, we should have won in in Christchurch in the second test, and then we were beaten 60-0 the week after. I think if we played them next week again, they'd be probably more nervous now that it'd get very spiky. And
there's an assumption that what we've done is rouse the beast a year out from the World Cup. But what we've also done is put this massive question mark in the heads of New Zealand rugby, that they're not infallible, that they are human, that they make mistakes, that we've put doubt into their team.
Aside from putting doubt into their heads, we've put belief into our mentality that we now have an incredibly consistent, good team who can perform at that level. And, you know, some people have said then, are we peaking too early? And is this the same story? Will we, you know, fail at the world? That's in the future. You deal in the present, and sports people have to deal in the present. I think everybody outside of the team environment will be talking about World Cups and, you know, another Grand Slam, and they'll set their targets about winning a Grand Slam now. And that's fine to believe you can do that and put your targets up on a board and say, this is what we want to achieve, and do that goal setting. And we've got to deal with the here and now. And here and now, you know, they produced a scintillating performance, which could have been better.
Yeah.
Some of the execution, some of the mistakes. But they look comfortable, Ger, and that's a really, really good thing.
So
that banana skin and that monkey on the back scenario of the World Cup next year, I think they can cope with that because they've now kind of got rid of that All Black scenario. They did in 2016, they've backed it up. So I think the mentality is very, very strong. Joe Schmidt deserves incredible credit for what he's done with the group.
We didn't really talk that much about Wayne Barnes in the aftermath of this game because the penalty count is massively in our favour. But there is a period in the first half where there's four or five penalties in a row. There's the deliberate knock-on from... Is it Ritalik who's on the ground?
Whitelock. Yeah, and I had the ref link on. I'm listening to the conversation. And to be fair, I thought that the warning should have come earlier. But I thought the Whitelock one, even if it's only the second penalty in the game, it's deliberate.
It's an automatic yellow card, isn't it?
And it should have been a yellow card.
And after that is the chip through for the Rob Kearney. So, and there's a penalty advantage at that point as well. It's like three or four penalties that come at that point. So, I thought we kind of killed them in that first half, and that in retrospect, there should have been a yellow card. And I don't know why Wayne Barnes doesn't penalise.
He needed to yellow card there, and but they didn't panic the players either. You know, Rory Best was having conversations with him. I thought Kieran Reid was kind of following him around every time, questioning all the decisions. But Steve Hansen said it after the game, they were really silly penalties, but they're cynical and they have that in them.
Yeah.
If they're penalised for
a
penalty,
if you get away with it, you're going to get away with
it. They'll back it up with another penalty, and when teams get in their 22 and put any sort of sustainable pressure on them, they'll give away a penalty. There could have been more, Ger. And it sounds, maybe I have the green goggles on here, but the offside line at times was they were shooting up a bit early, and a little bit of execution, and we could have got a try or two in that sustained period. But
yeah,
they managed to cope with that, and they didn't drop their heads. And but the Whitelock one was a definite yellow, and you know. So overall, I think the other issue, and I said it on Friday, was maybe more of a contest at a breakdown, and Wayne Barnes tends to kind of not allow a contest very quickly. But, you know, he did fine, I think. But if we'd lost the game, we'd certainly be looking back at that period. It was 9 penalties to New Zealand at one stage and 1 to Ireland at half-time. 9 penalties to 1. Ireland's discipline was was brilliant. And for one of their kickable penalties, they didn't roll away. So it wasn't as if Ireland were being silly and giving away stupid penalties.
Yeah.
But New Zealand did. But that's credit to Ireland for the pressure they were putting them under.
When it became clear that Ireland were on song on Saturday night, were you ever really worried at any point?
I was worried in the last 20 minutes, I think. When we lost the line out down on the 5-yard line the second half after the Stockdale try, I thought that was a great opportunity to, even if you don't score there, that you stay there for 5-10 minutes,
yeah,
force something, take a bit more out of their legs. We lost that line out, and then we looked a little bit panicky. We started making a few errors, a few loose kicks. And, you know, they had a couple of opportunities. The O'Mahony one where he scooped the ball up, if that bounces, if it runs on another yard, Ben Smith is possibly in for a try. Barrett is close to the line. He offloads it. Kearney gets in there. The Reid one before the try, where he knocks it on. So a little bit of luck there, but I think Ireland created their luck, and if the balance of the game, I think they were unlucky to Ireland on a few occasions. So I was panicky there, yeah, no doubt. But that's a natural thing. I think everybody was probably a bit nervous, certainly when we kicked away some balls towards the end of the game.
What are we doing?
Well, Luke McGrath said it, Joey Carberry.
Yeah,
he blamed him straight away. Was calling it.
There's the bus.
But I had no problem with the kicking, but some of it was inaccurate, and maybe at times there wasn't enough of a chase. And to be fair, the players were tired and fatigued, and New Zealand threw everything at it. You know, they brought on Richie Moonga, they put Barrett to full back, they brought on Leonard Brown, they brought on a lot of pace, power, and energy, if you like. And Ireland just stayed really connected in defence and defended really intelligently. What I was impressed with is didn't do up and in defence from the outside channel. They went really hard in that 10-12 channel, because so I mentioned it the other day about, you know, the way Barrett gets off, pushes forward in that attacking line off scrums and lineouts where he takes it really flat. Ireland met that with strong resistance there, and it took away a bit of their impetus and their momentum going forward. So, to be fair to Andy Farrell, he deserves a lot of credit
for getting
that shape and organisation as well.
In fairness, he's getting a lot of it. The New Zealand Herald, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later on, with one of their writers, have pinpointed him, because it's the second time that he's come up against the All Blacks with the Lions, obviously, as well, that they haven't scored a try. And I think, to put that feat in perspective, six times this century in 243 tests have New Zealand managed to not score a try in a game. Twice are Andy Farrell's defence. It's not bad.
Yeah, it's incredible. And but look, the players have got to do it. He gives them the information and shows them where they attack and where you need to be strong and where you need to really chop that momentum away from them. So the players execute it. But he inspires people as well. So he loves a challenge. He did as a player. And, you know, he would have had the players really buzzing to make those tackles. I thought Stander was, you know, he hasn't been his best season so far, and it's hard to keep the level of performance going. Now, if you look at his stats, he's 22 or 3 carries the other day again, and 16 or 17 tackles.
Yeah.
James Ryan is up there.
Carries were
well.
Better in this game from Sander than they have been.
Yeah, they were. And Keane Healy made 14 or 15 carries as well. He was just incredible.
There's a case that James Ryan's the best player in world rugby.
He is the best second round world rugby. I said it before the game, and I meant it. I think he is the best second round world rugby.
He's got everything.
It's just unbelievable. When there's a defence in front of him, Ger, and he gets a ball, I was with Rog last week watching the Argentina game, and I said, watch his footwork, watch his body shape, watch how he can wriggle through little tight gaps, and the presentation is excellent every time.
Yeah.
He just has a great knack for running onto the ball. Even sometimes when he takes it static, he'll kind of ride a tackle and he'll step to the right or left. And then he has an ability of kind of bending down low and just getting through the tackle. And that people maybe mightn't see, you know, a big yardage gain, but it's the shape you get to place the ball again after that. And what a player. The tackle, I thought, himself and Toner put on Retallick was just unbelievable.
And there was
Toner went
the
high, and then James Ryan just comes straight through, hip height, drives him back. Psychologically, that works both ways. Lift to Ireland,
and the crowd's aflame because of it. Like,
yeah, and just his work right around the field is unbelievable.
I just want to bring you this comment, and it's like, you know, normally we wouldn't do this, but Conor Joyce, classic Ireland after winning a game that has the same meaning of an O'Byrne Cup match. This is a country that's never won a knockout game with the World Cup and won't change that next year either.
That negativity is sad for me, and it's a reflection of the person himself, I think. We as rugby people, I passionately support the Irish soccer team. I passionately support my county, Tipperary. I love watching all the sport. I'm speaking for myself here, not for this gentleman. And I love celebrating Irish sporting success, whether it be Padraig Harrington or Rory McIlroy or hockey players in the summer. I find it strange that we look for negativity in an incredible We're an incredible sporting nation for a small nation. And I understand that some people have a problem maybe with rugby being a bit elitist. But I didn't come from an elitist background. I played club rugby. I captained the Irish youths. So I'm someone who came through the club system. It's not all about schools. There's loads of people. John Hayes in Brough didn't start playing rugby till he's 19. So I find it insulting when people say it's all about the schools and it's all about elitism. There's loads of rural places throughout Ireland who are playing rugby, and there's communities who love their rugby and diehards who go in and make the soup and sandwiches, and the women do that. And in my club in Tipperary, and people love their rugby. And it's not all, like, it is, of course there's a relevant point that it's a year out from the World Cup, but this is the second time we've beaten New Zealand. Probably the greatest rugby team that's ever been. Not this current team, but as a team, the All Blacks. And we find we're straight away going knock, knock, knock. It's just, it's unbelievable. My best sporting memories as a kid were some rugby ones, but Ray Houghton scoring in 88, Italia 90, you know, there's a lot of different ones that are other sports. Nicky English playing for Tip winning in All-Ireland in 89, 91. You know, I remember all the GAA games. I just find it, I have friends who are kind of...
A bit like that.
A bit like that.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying it's just this guy. There's some soccer guys I know who will go knocking the rugby a little bit. I know rugby has issues and maybe has some elitism there, but I think rugby... Soccer, GA, all the sports, and I'm biased towards this, could learn from rugby the way they go out in the communities, the way the job the IRFU have done, the way the provinces have united people. In rugby, it has hurt the clubs a little bit, but the way they treat the referees, the way fans can go to matches together, kids can go to matches, the fans mix with each other after games. I know that happens a lot in GA, but soccer is a major issue for that. So kind of going, it's only a friendly. It's not a friendly. It's they're test matches. We don't have other competitions that we play in rugby at international level that you can play during the year. We have the Six Nations, and I know the World Cup comes around every 4 years. Then you have the test matches. These are November tests. I understand the concept that somehow there's nothing at stake.
Yeah.
Try telling that to the players of any international rugby team.
You see the media and their management team. We're nearly out of time here, but before we go... is Joe Schmidt the next New Zealand manager, coach after this? Is that what happened? Is that what we've seen? Because like Steve Hansen said he's made his mind up and he's going to announce before Christmas. This is all looking like it's all a little bit... The timing is very precipitous for everybody.
Well, would you blame Joe Schmidt? To be fair, he's been 11 years away. He's had this incredible success. And would you blame him to go back and coach New Zealand? No, you wouldn't. And you would. We'd applaud him. So it's looking that it's a possibility. I know there's been no decision made in New Zealand, and I'm not sure. Maybe they've had a chat with Joe and to see would he be interested. It won't be down to money, because I think the RFU will pay Joe Schmidt what he wants, and he's someone I think he'll base it on the family decision. So I'm fearful that it's going to happen that that he may go. I hope I'm wrong. I think it'd be great if he stayed. But I'm fearful that it is going to happen. And, you know, for him to go back home and to be able to coach his own national side as well and start a new kind of project and bring his family back there would be totally understandable. But he's the greatest rugby coach we've ever had, and probably one of our greatest ever sporting coaches as well, for what he's achieved with the team.
There's an assumption that that Andy Farrell is in the pole position, but that maybe Farrell and Lancaster could be reunited again. What's your take on all that?
Yeah, they could be. I'd like to see, I'd love to see O'Gara involved somewhere there, if there was a change, because I think it'd be a great opportunity. He keeps saying to me that he wants to, take a head coach job next, and maybe he's still on that learning curve, but I think it'd be great to see him get back involved. I don't think Leinster would be happy if they were to lose Stuart Lancaster again, but the national team is the number one priority here. So Lancaster, Farrell, it'd be brilliant what Stuart Lancaster has done here with Leinster. But, you know, I think if Joe Schmidt left, you then have, you know, not that detail and that knowledge that he's left behind with the other coaches as well. And they bring their own strengths as well. Andy Farrell might do something different, but I think it's a natural kind of succession plan.
Yeah.
And I think the RFU will be preparing that. They probably know themselves now. So it's not the end of the world if he leaves that we're just going to collapse, because I think his legacy and what he will leave behind whenever he goes will be phenomenal. And other coaches will have their own ideas. So, but yeah, Lancaster and Farrell would be a brilliant mix.
Yeah, because it's on the back of the papers today. And you're like, woof, maybe that's taking a little bit of the gloss off our historic victory. But actually, we're in a not bad situation where we've just
done the age profile. I know there's a few older players in the team, but the age profile is pretty good. There's a lot of young players there who will, you think they'll be around for 8-10 years with that team.
Yeah, fingers crossed. All right, Alan, good stuff. Thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Here's Luke McGrath speaking to Off the Ball after Saturday night's historic win.
You were watching on there and just seeing the intensity of the rest of the team as they're putting in that performance. How hard is it to get up to that level coming off the bench?
Yeah, it is difficult. It's probably it's a challenge. You definitely learn from being on the bench and trying to make an impact. But I try to concentrate on the first thing I can do, the first phase I'm involved in, to try and be a positive one and kind of build from there, take it from moment to moment. But yeah, I was watching on that game, and you know, you never know when the call's going to come, so it's always a bit difficult in that way. But I just know when I come on, you know, it's a massive opportunity, and you know, you have to attack New Zealand if you want to win. You can't kind of sit back, and we probably gave them the ball for the last 20 minutes, but you know, our defence dug in the end, and thankfully we won.
Yeah, that box kick you did towards the end, and I think there's a few fans around us kind of getting very worried. Were you nervous yourself when you were taking that decision? Yeah. What was going through your mind?
I knew it was a big box kick. I had a look up at the clock. I knew it was about 78 minutes, about 2 minutes to go. And, you know, we trust our defence so much, so that if we do, it was just on me to put up a contestable kick and hopefully Jacob gets it back. But, you know, obviously it's a 50-50 battle up in the air, and I think they won the scraps then. And then, you know, it's next job. We have to kind of defend for that minute. And, you know, I thought we defended quite well, but then next thing you know, we're on our 22 and you're kind of like, okay, we have to dig in deep here with all the lads. And, you know, it was obviously delighted to see, you know, our defence win in the end and get that victory, which was brilliant. But yeah, I was concentrated a lot on that fox kick.
Luke, it was great images of when Jacob got his try. You guys absolutely mobbing him, everyone in the orange bit. Were you guys watching that, like half an eye on it, or you're supposed to be warming
up?
Yeah,
well, you know, that play that Jacob scored off, you know, you do that during the week and you're never sure if it's going to work off in the game. And you know, thankfully it did. And once Jacob gets an opportunity, you know, he saw that, I think it was Ben Smith, come up into the line, the space in behind, and that chip. And you know, once he gets those opportunities, he's absolutely ruthless. He's an unbelievable try scorer. So yeah, like you say, I was probably jumping up and down. I don't know what happened. It was just incredible excitement. But then you kind of have to, you know, relax, get into your warm up routine, and you know, you'll be on the pitch, and you know, you never know when you're going to be pitched. So but yeah, it was an incredible moment.
With the intensity of that game, watching it from the press box, the 80 minutes seemed to fly over. As a player, what was it like? Did it fly over?
It doesn't fly over really at all. I'll tell you that. When you're sitting on the bench, it goes very slowly. But it's important, you know, when you're on the bench, you just got to realise, you know, take your time. You never know when you will be on, but I knew, I was told on 57 that I'd be coming on around 60, so I knew I had to get myself ready mentally and just go out and, you know, have a go and see what happens.
Yeah, he played pretty well. I don't think it's a done deal that Kieran Marmion is the automatic replacement if Conor Murray goes down again.
Far from it, I would say.
They're right there, nipping at each other's heels, which is exactly the situation you want.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it seems that it's all going to come down to this one word or phrase that is going to be thrown around: box kicking. Who is the better box kicker when it comes to Luke McGrath or Kieran Marmion? It seems that is going to become the tiebreaker. And Kieran Marmion's taken a lot of stick post Saturday night for his box kicking. Papers yesterday and a couple of the analysis pieces, good performance, except for the one thing. And it is the thing that has been levelled against him for quite some time. The thing is, are we actually really comparing him to Luke McGrath in that respect? Or because Marmion is quite often the starter whenever Conor Murray is out, more like for the majority of the time he's the starter when Murray's out, we're actually judging Marmion by Conor Murray's box-kicking standards?
Two things. I think it's very difficult for anybody to, outside the team setup, know exactly what they're looking for when he's... So there's a box-kick that everybody goes, and I put inverted commas in there if you're listening to us on the radio, that the chase isn't good enough or it goes too far. There's a consensus that that's not great, but actually it could have been a perfect execution by the player according to what management wanted. So I'm basically saying we don't have access to the proper video analysis, and the sense that, okay, the hang time on that kick was 3.5 seconds, which is exactly what it should be, but the winger was out of position, or the centre didn't chase, or whatever.
Do you know, so well, Andy was saying yesterday that the hang time isn't 3.5 seconds. It's
whatever it was. I mean, it's
a lot shorter than Conor Murray's hang time, basically, is what Andy was saying yesterday. So that's the one thing we can deduce from all of this. Like, but that being said.
But is Andy sitting there with a stopwatch every single time, the way that the Ireland skills coach and video analysts are doing? Like, I know he's watching it with like 15 years of professional experience, and so his opinion is brilliant. But I do wonder if, like, they'll get a video at the end of the game where every single kick is analysed, and I don't know if we actually can tell the difference enough.
Yeah, well, I certainly wouldn't be able to tell the difference, but when I see an educated opinion giving their take after watching the game in the stadium the other night, I tend to say, well, there must be some sort of truth in that. I don't know. There is also the element that maybe the Irish coaching team just look at Marmion and Conor Murray and indeed Luke McGrath, and they look at their respective styles of kicking and they say to themselves, well, this is international rugby. There's only so much we can actually work on here in terms of basic skill development, that we're actually going to alter our game around the kicking potential of our scrum half. That actually they are saying to Marmion, well, this is what you do well. This type of box kick is exactly suited to you. You can execute this perfectly. We are now going to move our resources in a way that will complement that better. So Ireland perhaps set up better, get quicker off the line, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I'd say, though, that it's going to come down to who's in form in 11 months' time. And that's where we're at. Who is in the best form? And who puts the best body of work together between now and then?
Yeah. I would have said Luke McGrath would have been the starter if we were going on form though recently, right?
Well, like, so I mean, you're injured at the end of last season, didn't go on the didn't get the opportunity over the summer that you might have expected.
Yeah.
Like, Marmion never lets Ireland down.
When it comes to Irish form, it's a different thing. But in terms of club form, perhaps you'd have Luke McGrath at a higher pedestal. But it's different. Like, the idea that we say, kind of refer to a Joe Schmidt player as a bad thing is a nonsense, really, because it's a very good thing. A Joe Schmidt player always tends to do the business, even when we think that they might not be in a position to do so.
Speaking of Joe Schmidt players, Rob Kearney, not fit, brilliant. Mm. Like, amazing performance from Kearney.
Yeah, at the start of this year, we were talking about Kearney losing his place indefinitely.
We weren't.
Well,
no. Were you?
No, well, there was a serious question that Jordan Larmour was going to start instead of Rob Kearney at the start of the Six Nations, and that we should perhaps be thinking of a shake-up. Post the Six Nations, there was absolutely no question that Rob Kearney was our starting fullback. Post Saturday night, he's absolutely indispensable at this point. He is sensational.
Yeah.
And to call it a renaissance is just not the correct word, because this is probably the best form of his entire career.
Kearney-sance.
Let's forget that word was ever just said.
No.
Please, let's never use the word Kearney-sance
here
ever again.
But I don't think it's even close anymore. I don't think that that's ever up for discussion again until Kearney's like saying, okay, I'm retiring. The difference between where he is at the moment and where everybody else who is a potential fullback in the team is at the moment is so stark.
Yeah, it is. Like, just on speaking of fullbacks and Quinny talking there about Bowden Barrett being moved to 15 on Saturday night, I wonder, is that the final decision made in Sexton versus Barrett for the World Rugby Player of the Year? And I'm not sure if a vote's already been made or not, but I do wonder, if you're the best out half in the world, are you really in a position that you should be moved back to 15? Or if you're the best out half in the world, does the head coach look at you and say, well, you're the best out half in the world, I'm not moving you from 10? And Steve Hansen clearly didn't think that about Bowden Barrett on Saturday night.
I don't know. I think that probably if you're like one of the best players in the world and your sub fullback isn't, or your fullback isn't going great, and you're like, yeah, okay, well, you can still control the game if you're that good, and you can come in to 10 at various stages. I don't know. I think that if the vote was already made, then that's bullshit, frankly.
Yeah.
Like, if people were voting before this game on who was the best player in the world, you have to vote after this game, because it's 1 versus 2. And it's the opportunity for everybody to put their hand up. Was James Ryan shortlisted? I don't know. I didn't see.
Literally just thinking that as you were speaking there. Because he should be. It's a consistent body of work for the entire calendar year. I don't think he was.
You just talk amongst yourself there for a second and I'll and let's actually go back to
James Ryan's already put himself into, he's probably the favourite for the 2019 World Rugby Player of the Year. If he doesn't get shortlisted this year, then there must be some sort of waiting on last year's performances.
One Northern Hemisphere, and that is Johnny Sexton.
There you go. That's a bit of a joke, isn't it?
Yeah.
There must be some sort of waiting in terms of what was done at the start of last season.
Faf de Klerk, Rico Ione, Malcolm Marks from South Africa, alongside Boden Barrett and Johnny Sexton.
Sexton's going to win it.
Well, I mean, if he doesn't, we'll be pinning that in the dressing room wall.
Well, we need something to get angry about now, because everything's just too happy-happy. If we actually want to feed ourselves into an Irish inferiority complex for a second here.
Oh, don't worry. They just have to check Twitter and see that a lot of Irish people think they're full of shit.
Well, yeah.
Like, a sizable minority.
A
vocal minority of people think that this is all nonsense.
They're like magpies.
It's all stuff and nonsense.
They're like magpies. They each need to see a shiny thing for it to mean something. If it doesn't have a trophy or a medal attached, then it means absolutely F all.
Let's bring in some Kieran Reid. Here's what he had to say in the aftermath of the game.
Well, look, no, I think it showed right up to that final whistle. We know he had control of the ball. There's belief in our squad. Like, you know, we've got belief no matter what situation we're in. And still we had that today. I think Ireland were just, you know, too good for us. And put enough pressure on us to force a mistake right at the end, and that's the way it goes sometimes. So, but yeah, look, you know, I felt we still had some confidence within our group to, you know, to try and snatch a draw, but it wasn't to be.
Yeah, I mean, they could have snatched a draw. They were pretty close. Like, they're on the 22 when the knock-on happens.
Mm. Yeah, like, I'd love to know the discourse now if we'd actually drawn that game.
Because blown, opportunity blown, chokers.
Let's just say Wayne Barnes' head would be appearing in urinals all around Dublin.
I mean, I did think that every time you see anybody with a deliberate knock on, especially when they're on the ground, it's not like it was kind of disguised, oh, I'm trying to catch the ball. Yeah. It was like, what? Clearly from a power play, like New Zealand paranoid about what we're going to do off the line out, and as it turned out, rightly so. I don't know, I think that maybe the pre-match hysteria from the All Blacks got to Wayne Barnes, and there's a bit of a lesson there. Like, if you are going to be the best team in the world, you're fighting war on several fronts, and one of those fronts is like with the referee, with the opposition, with the fans, just to make sure that anyway, look, Joe Smith's pretty good at all that stuff.
Yeah, it's a vital part of all of this. The other thing is kind of in the context of the World Cup next year and all that, how good a result was Saturday night for World Rugby? That does it open things up now to the point where it's like there's 4 or 5 potential World Cup winners in the world now.
Absolutely.
Whereas we haven't had that since maybe 2003. In hindsight, 2007, but I guess 2007...
Ah, yeah, 2007 they could have, like, you would not have been surprised.
It was a good England team, obviously, very good All Blacks team, excellent France and South Africa teams, obviously, supposedly, best Ireland team of all time. I think we're kind of approaching a similar enough level next year. It depends what the likes of Eddie Jones can do with England over the next 12 months. You suspect he won't be able to get him back into a position to contend for a World Cup. All Blacks are going to be there. You would imagine the Razzie Erasmus revolution in South Africa is going to continue. Ireland are going to be there and thereabouts. And who knows what the likes of the Aussies and the Welsh are going to do.
I did forget that New Zealand only won the World Cup in 2011 by, that's the France game, the 8-7. So they could easily have choked at any stage in that tournament as well.
Yeah, and like France had like 3 missed penalties in that game. That feels like a long time ago at this point. That feels like a different world, and it was this decade. Remember 2011 when we weren't the best team in world rugby? It was a sad time, wasn't it?
When they weren't.
Imagine not being the best at rugby in the world. Imagine being like from New Zealand and you're not the best team in the world. That'd be a terrible existence. I'd hate to be from New Zealand this morning and being, you know, bad at rugby.
Yeah, let's bring you some Ron Nugent. Here he was on Sunday's pay-per-view, obviously commentating on the game for Channel 4 on Saturday night. Have a look.
Totally.
Yeah, and
totally.
For what it's worth, I hear where he's coming from, but I had a quick look at the New Zealand Herald last night and a couple of other sites, and they very clearly covered what Steve Hansen had to say about Ireland and being the best team in the world and all the rest of it. But I do think one of the things we haven't touched on is final word on this for me anyway. I think that in some ways, Hansen will, at the back of his head, will give his players and his squad a wake-up call that they probably needed. Going through an entire season and going into a World Cup without really believing and knowing that there's a couple of teams there that can beat you.
Yeah.
I don't think that's any good for anybody. No.
Okay, so to pick up from Ryan Nugent's point there, I'm delighted to say we've got Gregor Paul of the New Zealand Herald back with us. Gregor, how you doing?
Oh, very well, thanks.
So the point that Ryan Nugent was making there is that in the long run, a defeat now for Steve Hansen is actually not the worst thing that might have happened. It's not a bad way for the season to end. It's a bit of a kick up the ass and just a reminder that there are challenges out there that they're going to have to face in the future.
Oh, look, for sure. I mean, it's not a bad thing to get a reminder. But by the way, I don't actually think that the All Blacks needed a reminder of how good Ireland are. I don't think there was any doubt in their minds about what kind of contest they were going to be getting themselves into playing against Ireland. But it's good to get that. I don't know if it's a reality check. I'm not sure what I would call it, but it's a fairly sobering business for the All Blacks to wake up on a Sunday morning. It's unusual for them to look at a game and go, look, we were outplayed. You know, we were outthought, we were outplayed. Ireland were better in every department that you want to go through. Not by much, but by enough to get the game won. And, you know, the thing for me was, and the great thing for everybody there was no refereeing controversies. It didn't swing on a decision by a referee. There was no injustice perceived by either team. It was just a classically good test match. Both teams went at each other. And in the end, you know, Ireland were better, and they took their one opportunity, really, to score a brilliant try, and the All Blacks didn't take theirs, and Ireland go home the winners, and that'll hurt the All Blacks for quite a while, because they'll have to go back home now and think, you know, Ireland are better than we are right now, so what can we do in the next 10, 11 months to make sure that when we go to the World Cup, we're the better team?
Speaking of which, in the aftermath, Hansen said that we're trying to transform our style or change our style from one way of playing to another, and we're still stuck a little bit in the old style. What's he talking about? What is he trying to achieve, and what does the new version of the All Blacks look like versus the old version?
Well, good question. We asked him and we didn't really get much of an answer beyond that. He wasn't really too keen to give it away. Like, I don't really know. I think there was a couple of things in that game, I think, probably where I felt the All Blacks were a wee bit predictable, and Ireland knew what was coming at them, didn't they? They had Brodie Retallick lined up in the middle of the field, and your young lock there, whose name escapes me,
James Ryan. Yeah.
Well, he was good, you know. He lined them up. Devin Toner was good, and they knew where the All Blacks were coming at, and they were good enough and physical enough to repel that challenge. So in terms of what the All Blacks are doing, we're not really... I don't think it'll be anything major. You know, probably at their level, it'll be something subtle. It'll be moving the way that they attack first up. I don't really know what he was talking about there, but obviously in their world, it's causing them a bit of grief that whatever transition they are trying to make, they're not doing it particularly well. And I think that's probably true because they haven't looked quite right for the last half of this year. They haven't really flowed. They haven't got that attack game going, particularly against South Africa. They struggled against England. They didn't get it going either. So there is some kind of transition going on there. I suspect it's quite subtle, and they haven't found what it is that they're trying to do yet. So how significant that is, we'll find out. I mean, I wouldn't doubt that the All Blacks have got more in them. I think we'll see them improve. There's no doubt about that. They always go away after a defeat and come back a wee bit stronger. But how significant it is, we'll have to wait to see, I think.
In terms of Beauden Barrett, you are writing this morning in the New Zealand Herald about it might now be time for him to become a fullback at international level. What's your thinking behind that, and how likely is that to happen? Because we saw it in a small portion of the game at the weekend.
Well, I mean, it happens a lot anyway. In terms of like, there's a kind of a genuine move on his part in the back half of most test matches when they bring Moanga off the bench. Barrett goes back to fullback, and that's been the way really for quite some time now. And if you look at the way that the All Blacks set themselves up, Barrett plays quite a lot at fullback anyway. I mean, the numbers on their backs in the All Blacks between 10 and 15, but they're not hugely different what they want both players to do. When McKenzie plays there, they both come up as first receiver, they both drop back. So I just think at the moment the All Blacks need a little bit more balance in their back line. They're not as composed in the face of that kind of defensive onslaught that Ireland produced. You know, they get shut down a little bit. And I think Moanga is probably the better player at dealing with that traffic, at making those decisions on the run. But the beauty of playing Barrett on the field and Mwanga on the field is that they're the two best playmakers in the team. And that's kind of what my point is. Whether one wears 10 and one wears 15, I actually wouldn't get too hung up about that. I think the point I'm trying to make is that Mwanga needs to come into the team and be on the field from the start and give the All Blacks that dual playmaking role that McKenzie can't quite give them, because I think Ireland exposed him a wee bit. The kicking game was very good. He's not a big man. You know, he really isn't. He's tiny, and he got found out a wee bit. He's brave. He's courageous. He goes for it. But I just think, sadly, to play Test match rugby as a fullback, you have to be a wee bit bigger than him.
Gregor, in terms of who might come into the All Blacks team who was missing on Saturday, like maybe Sonny Bill Williams gets his form back and finds a place in the centre. Are there many other changes that, say, you know, all things being equal, we're on the verge of a World Cup? Is this largely the team, or are there significant changes, do you think?
I don't think there'll be significant changes. I don't think you'd want to be thinking that 11 months out of the World Cup, you haven't identified the wider group of players that you're going to take. I mean, clearly you want to have done that as a coach at this stage. Sam Kane's back home injured, but Ardy Savea played particularly well at open side, so I'm not sure that would make a huge difference. Sonny Bill, you're right, if he can get himself back into form, his offloading would make the All Blacks a more dangerous team. I don't recall them getting an offload away against Ireland. And being able to stress the defence by putting someone through, you know, on the back of an offload to get one step beyond the defence. We didn't see that. They're not quite set up in the back three. They've got Waisaki Naholo, who hasn't played for a wee while. Whether he comes into the team and gives them something, not sure. But I think, and I wouldn't for one minute want to take anything away from Ireland's outstanding victory, but I think probably Sam Whitelock was on his last legs. He's had a huge year. He doesn't have a lot of energy left in the tank. And Retallick was a wee bit empty because he's hardly played this year as well and drained himself at Twickenham and just couldn't back it up. And that's not to take anything away from Ireland. That's just to say, I think if you get those two back at full noise, you get a different kind of All Black type five coming at you. So maybe they're a wee bit jaded at the end of a long year. That's not to take away from Ireland, but that's maybe an area where the All Blacks have got a bit of upside to come.
You said there that obviously the All Blacks were quite aware of the challenge that Ireland would bring, and they're more aware than most other nations about the particular challenges that a Joe Schmidt side would bring. But particularly given the manner of the win, do you think that those who run rugby in New Zealand will now be more eager to get Joe Schmidt into the camp and perhaps as a future head coach? I mean, I say as a future head coach, I mean, after the next World Cup, Schmidt says he's going to announce his future before the end of the year.
Oh, look, I don't think it will change anything. I don't think Joe suddenly surprised everyone or become something that nobody didn't already know that he was. He's clearly an outstanding coach. I mean, look how good Ireland have become in the period that he's been coaching them. I mean, they really do, genuinely. I know the world ranking's probably still number two, but I think genuinely you're looking at them now. I mean, if they are number two, it's only just, isn't it? They're right up there as the best team in the world. You don't win as many games as they do without being well coached. So no, I don't think that's really going to change a great deal. I think that, you know, Steve Hansen's got a pretty good record himself. Let's not forget that. And if he wants to stay on as All Blacks coach, I think that's an opportunity that's been put to him. Do you want to go on beyond 2019? So I think that's kind of stage one. He's got to determine whether he's going to stay on or whether he's pulling out. And if he is pulling out, then look, Joe's going to be an outstanding candidate. I don't think what happened on Saturday will have much of a bearing on that at all. I think if he applied for the job, he'd be pretty hard to turn down long before he beat the All Blacks.
That's interesting, because we kind of assumed that there was the prerequisite, really, for somebody who wanted the All Blacks job to be already in the system in New Zealand. Perhaps for somebody like Joe Schmidt, you make an exception?
Oh, they've got various rules and regulations, but from memory, they're always willing to make exceptions. So I think effectively, you know, Hansen and Henry were appointed on exceptions because they both came out of Wales into the All Blacks job. So, look, if Joe put his hand up, if the job became available and Joe put his hand up, I don't think New Zealand Rugby Union are going to say, but you haven't been coaching in New Zealand, Joe, sorry, we're not going to give you the job. Look, the most important thing to coach the All Blacks, despite what any rules might say, is having experience in international rugby. And, you know, right now, if you didn't make Joe Schmidt the next All Blacks coach, who would you? You know, I mean, he's clearly I mean, there's an internal candidate who would be Ian Foster, who's already with the All Blacks. But other than Foster, where else are the All Blacks going to go? I mean, clearly Joe's going to be the guy. If the job becomes available, they're going to make a pretty big play and persuade him to come home and take it.
Hansen has said he's going to make his decision before Christmas. Joe Schmidt has said he's going to make his announcement sometime in the next couple of weeks as well. The paranoid Irish rugby fans are looking at that and it's like, oh, these timings are all coalescing very nicely here. What's your instinct on what's going to happen?
I would imagine that there's clearly a bit of a rapport between Schmidt and Hansen. They clearly have a lot of respect for one another. They're quite friendly. I would imagine that Steve has already told Joe what his intentions are. He hasn't told anyone else, Hansen. We don't know what he's going to do. So I genuinely don't know if he's going to move on or if he's going to stand aside. But I suspect that he's already made his mind up and he's already come to an agreement with the New Zealand Rugby Union, whichever way he's going to go. And I suspect that he's told Joe what he's doing, whether he's staying or whether he's going. And I would imagine that will have a bearing on what Joe is going to do. And if Steve is staying on, I would imagine that Joe is probably staying on with Ireland. And if Steve is moving on from the All Blacks, I'd imagine that Joe is probably sitting there going, well, I'm probably going to have a tilt at the All Blacks job.
Yeah, you mentioned that the obvious qualities that Steve Hansen has as a coach. And I do wonder if he's underrated hugely in this part of the world. Like, I do wonder, say, if you flip the tables on Saturday night, if Steve Hansen was Ireland coach and Joe Schmidt was All Blacks coach, would we have had the same result?
Look, that's an impossible question to answer. It's too difficult to know what would happen. Look, Hansen's been brilliant for the All Blacks. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, anyone can coach the All Blacks. Look at the players that they've got. But, you know, the players just don't fall out of trees and get, you know, and happen to arrive like that. I mean, they have to be molded into that. They have to be developed like that. They have to, you know, they have to come through a system where ultimately the All Black coach has a fair amount of say, you know, across the country around, you know, the skill sets and the type of rugby that they want to see played, and then that filters down to Super Rugby, and then they try and build these players and having the right sort of skills that the All Blacks are after. So it's a whole kind of pyramid, as it is in Ireland. I'm sure it's the same kind of thing. But Hansen's been brilliant. He's been a fantastic selector. He's barely picked a dud. He's barely lost a game. I mean, I don't know, what have they lost? 7-8 test matches in 7-8 years, which, you know, that's almost why it's such a big deal when they do lose, because it happens so rarely now. So whenever they lose, which, you know, once a year, twice a year, it becomes sort of a big inquest. What went wrong here? You got to sort of remember it's not normal to only lose one game a year or two games a year over such a long period. I know Ireland have had that kind of year at the moment, but, you know, they don't always have that kind of year. In fact, they rarely have that kind of year where they only lose one game. So this is what the norm is for the All Blacks, what Ireland are going through at the moment. That's a kind of normal season. So you put that into perspective and go, wow, you know, no previous All Blacks coach has been able to deliver those kind of results. And the other thing you have to remember, and Hansen said it a few times when he was in Ireland, every time the All Blacks play, the team that they play against, and Ireland proved it again on the weekend, are going to have one of those amazing days where they find another 10% in their own performance because they're so determined to knock over the All Blacks. And I think everyone could see that, you know, Ireland's determination to win that game was quite phenomenal. And, you know, if they weren't playing the USA this weekend, if they were off to go and play South Africa, say, in Dublin, I'd be interested to see how they coped, because I'm not sure that Ireland would be able to get up and knock over South Africa after what they put into that game against the All Blacks.
We'd be pretty confident.
I'm sure not. They're a great team, but it is hard to drain the tank like that and then back up and do it again.
It's a fair point. We're 11 months out from the World Cup. We've got plenty of prognosticating to do between now and then. Gregor, glad you enjoyed yourself, and I hope you had a good night on Saturday in Dublin either way.
Indeed.
Nice one. Gregor Paul from the New Zealand Herald. Thanks so much for joining us. Right. Here is what Steve Hansen had to say in the aftermath of the game, talking about Ireland being the best team in the world.
Well, you'll make them favourites, so if you want to make them favourites, go ahead. What it does do, I think, and I said this at the beginning of the week, you had the two best sides in the world playing each other, so as of now, they're the number one team in the world. So I guess they are favourites. I'll ask you, how do you reckon they'll be? Doing the jig? Like, obviously, they're disappointed. You know, like, you don't win as many rugby matches as this All Black team has, and then when you get beaten, it hurts, regardless of who you play and how well the opposition have played. And so, you know, the simple answer is that it's very quiet, sombre, people are gutted, and that's the way it should be. That's how you should feel when you get beaten.
Yeah, Steve Hansen there. Phil is here this morning. Phil, how are you?
Good, yeah.
Let's talk about the other big story. Is it a big story?
Well, huge.
It is a big story. Ireland are playing football tonight, yeah. And we barely mentioned it.
I know, but that's just unfortunately where the Irish football team is at the moment. But they're going to look to finish 2018 with a win. They face Denmark and Aarhus in the Nations League. Disappointing year for the boys in green so far. They've just 1 point in Group 4. We know that Ireland have been relegated to League C because over the weekend Denmark beat Wales in Cardiff, so the Danes are guaranteed a place in League A. James McLean is suspended for tonight's game. Uncapped striker from Southampton, Michael Obafemi, could earn his debut after committing his future to Ireland last week. But still no word on whether Declan Rice will follow suit. But Martin O'Neill was asked about the West Ham teenager at the press conference in Denmark yesterday, and it got a bit heated.
To think about putting him on for a couple of minutes at the end of the game in a match just to cap him competitively, it's crazy. Crazy thinking that that's what you should be doing, that you should have your mindset on that. And secondly, and probably as importantly as that, the player would know. So I would say, if Declan had thoughts about where he was going to play and who he was going to play for, I think that that would have reared its head at that particular time as well. So to have that sort of criticism directed at you is, I think, lunacy. Real lunacy.
I mean, I see both sides in this, right?
Yeah, it was the Moldova game, by the way, he was referencing the qualifier last year.
I definitely see him saying, I don't want anybody who doesn't want to be here, and I don't want to be bouncing people into playing for the team. But by not doing it, there's suddenly the chance for the owner of West Ham to think, oh, this guy's actually worth loads of money to me. For Gareth Southgate to go, yeah, I don't care about Ireland. I'll definitely take a Premier League standard centre-back or midfielder who can play in both positions.
We might need him someday.
And be good. Yeah. Absolutely. So, like, what you do is you open the window of opportunity. And it didn't seem to be an issue. I mean, wasn't he kissing the badge? Wasn't he just around time?
The under 21 game, yeah.
Yeah. Didn't he just kiss the badge?
Yeah.
So at some point, it's like, he likes us. You know, sometimes you've got to show that you love somebody. You've got to go out there and put it out in the line, right? And
say, as well, he was good enough to get into the team.
Well, not only that, he should have been starting.
Yeah, absolutely. But obviously, goals is where we're struggling. Only 4 goals in 2018. 2 against the USA. We scored in the defeat to Wales and in a friendly draw away to Poland. Former Ireland defender Darren O'Dea was on 98FM's And That's What I Call Sport yesterday with Jamie Moore, and he said even the best version of Robbie Keane wouldn't score on this team.
I'm looking at our strikers, and they take the heat for not scoring goals. They're probably paid the most money at their clubs because they're the most high profile, and they're taking the heat for not scoring goals. But a striker in that team, I don't know how they score goals, because they're nowhere near the opposition's goal for the whole game. They sit probably 40 yards from their own goal, and we're so deep as a team, the way we defend, they don't have a chance to score. So we could bring Robbie Keane back in our prime. He is not going to score in this team.
Is that true?
No. That's not true.
Will Kylian Mbappe score goals on our team?
Yes, obviously. He's Kylian Mbappe. Would Robbie Keane score goals on our team? Of course he would. He's Robbie Keane. He was a top-class Premier League striker. Name anybody in our team right now who's anywhere near Robbie Keane's level, peak Robbie Keane's level.
No one,
exactly.
But I think the point is, though, we don't...
They have to take some of the blame as well.
Absolutely, but we don't create any patterns of play that create chances. Watching the game against Northern Ireland the other night, they missed 2 one-on-ones because they created chances. Okay, yeah. People say we made mistakes. But we don't do that. Our best chance, we get excited from corners and free kicks.
Robbie would have scored from a corner or a free kick at some point, and also would have dived to win a penalty and stuck the penalty in, and we'd have been like, yeah, look, we're actually not that bad. We've got Robbie Keane in our team.
And also, Robbie Keane would have been up front, and he wouldn't care what the manager was saying. He would be giving out loads to his teammates, saying, what the hell are you doing? What are you doing passing the ball around, or not passing the ball around, I should say, and just hoofing it off the pitch? What the hell are you doing? Put the ball on the ground and get me the ball. I'm the best player in this team. Give me the ball and I will score. Like, he brought this cockiness, this arrogance that we are so badly lacking in so many areas. I completely agree with everything that, disagree with everything Darren O'Dea is saying there. The very thing we're missing is somebody of Robbie Keane's quality. It makes an awful difference. As John Giles would say, football is a simple game, and quite often one absolutely top-class football player can turn an international side.
Like, he would also create space by simply, by virtue of being Robbie Keane.
Yes.
At peak. I mean, you know, it's a terrible thing that we didn't...
I'd rather a ball-playing midfielder in there.
Well, look, I mean, if we have a shopping list, I'm like, let's have both.
I would take Perlo over Robbie Keane, don't get me wrong.
Okay, well, we'll move on to the Irish rugby team. They're going to be back on the training pitch today, ahead of Saturday's final November test against the USA. Joe Schmidt will make changes from Saturday's historic 16-9 win over the All Blacks at the Aviva. The mind games obviously started straight after the full-time whistle when New Zealand coach Steve Hansen labelled Ireland as World Cup favourites. Here's Joe Schmidt speaking after the match about how they kept the All Blacks tryless on Saturday night.
Look, you could ask Andy Farrell that. He's delighted, no doubt, because... It is so seldom that the All Blacks don't score a try, but as I just explained, there were three potential tries that we managed to scramble on. So on any given day, they might get a couple of those, and it's all different. They are the narrow margins. As I say, we almost got another couple, and Jacob Stockdale, what do you say? He got some good space down that short side, but once he controlled that chip ahead and... It was reminiscent, I thought, of the Twickenham one where he went down the short side with Connor Murray and got that chip over the top to get that try, which was crucial in giving us a bit of scoreboard separation against England.
It's mad, isn't it, how brilliant he is at talking about something other than the thing that's just happened. It's like, yeah, that reminds me of this one time when, you know, well, suddenly we're like all thinking about Twickenham briefly. Hang on a second. We asked you, you're the best team in the world, right? You're going to win the World Cup, Joe.
Yeah, we've got 11 months of this.
That game at Twickenham where something similar happened, and then there was this other game one time when I was in Ballinslow.
He did get kind of pressed on it about...
Mullingar, whatever it was, sorry.
The idea that the players deserve to be favourites and they deserve that tag of being contenders for the World Cup, and he says, well, no, seriously, what help is that? What can that help us achieve or improve?
He's right. Nothing.
He's right. Yeah. Exactly. Nothing.
Okay, well, obviously... Not all the focus was on the Fenway Classic because there was a lot of cracking club games yesterday. Ballygunner were crowned Munster Club senior hurling champions. The Waterford Kingpins gained revenge over an Apiercic of Limerick, beating the Limerick outfit by 2-14 to 2-8. Probably the game of the day was at Parnell Park. It had a bit of everything, but eventually Ballyboden St Enda's saw off Offaly champions Cooldairy by 5-28 to 5-25 after extra time at Parnell Park. Four red cards. Cooldairy finished with 12 men. Brian Carroll scored 2-16 for them before he was sent off. Here's Cooldairy manager Joachim Kelly speaking to Midlands after the game, and he felt they just didn't get the rub of the green.
I felt we had it won. He told us 3 minutes. He played six. You know, he made a draw of it. But look at that hurling for you. They came back. We went 10 minutes each half then. Draw again after each half. Then we had to go for five again. And look at the legs were on their last legs there for the last minute, you know, we lost by three, you know. Look at, that's Cooldairy for you, you know, they have great bottle and belly and everything, and they know how to win and when to win, and they expect to win every match, as I said earlier on to you in the year, you know. And we nearly did, and we had it done at the end of full time, you know, but look at referees and home venues, you know, maybe he was intimidated by the home crowd, the home venue, you know, we got no rub of the green there today.
So Ballyboden will play Ballyhale Shamrocks in the Leinster final. Henry Shefflin's Ballyhale beat Navan 6-21 to 4-11, 4-4 for Colin Fenley. St Thomas's were crowned Galway champions with a 2-13 to 10 points win over Liam Mellows. The Ulster football final will see Scotstown of Monaghan take on Donegal champions Gweedore, who are into their first ever provincial final. Gweedore got the better of Cross McLean by 4-11 to 16 points. Dara O'Boyle, 3 goals for Gweedore. Scotstown edged out Coleraine by 1-14 to 2-10 thanks to an injury time free from All-Star winning goalkeeper Rory Began. Three more Irish boxers will be looking to join Dubliner Kelly Harrington in the quarterfinals of the Women's Elite Championships in New Delhi. Kira Smith has just lost her last 16 bout on a split decision. And stand up if you love the darts, or as people are saying now, stand up if you love the farts. Gary Anderson's bizarre post-match interview from the Grand Slam of Darts. It's gone viral. The Scot beat Wesley Harm on Thursday. Wesley Harms, rather, on Thursday in Wolverhampton. But Harms said the reason he lost was down to the smell on the hockey. And this was put to Gary Anderson in an interview.
And besides that, he said you were a class player and you let him alive in the first session. And he said that it was smelly on the stage.
I thought Wesley had farted on stage. Yeah. Did he?
No. Well, I think he thinks you did it.
You can put your finger up that, so there'll be no smell there. I thought he had shit, and I went, that's dirty. It was bad.
It was bad?
It was bad. There was a stink. I thought it was him. And he started playing better. I went, must have needed to get some wind out.
Yeah. And he thought it was you?
Oh, no. Hands up. Swear on my kid's life. So help me God. Nothing crossed.
But it was smelly anyway.
It was smelly. Usually if I fart on stage, I sh** myself. And you know that, because I've told you in a documentary, ain't scared to... If I'd farted it smelled like that, I'd put my hands up and go, oh, sorry, I need to get off.
So who was it then?
Well, don't tell me. You've got another three boys up there. So... No, it definitely came from... It was table side. And it was. It was eggs. Rotten eggs.
Yeah. The darts. There you go. Revealed in all its glory.
You're going to absolutely... This is the story you've been waiting for all year.
I mean, you stick your finger up the house.
You've been sitting there.
You can smell it.
You've been sitting there trying to, what? You know, belittle our beautiful game that is darts. And lo and behold, it's a scandal. It's like the Festina affair. It's like the cricket ball tampering scandal. And now, finally, darts has its version. You know what? It brings a bit of glamour to us. It's, Gary Anderson will write his version of It's Not About the Bike. And then whoever the darts version of David Walsh will do kind of a book slash documentary about exposing Fartgate. And
the moment that darts, you know.
And there'll be kind of like a fraught affair between the Paul Kimmage of darts and Gary Anderson. And it'll just add a whole pile of glamour.
I mean, I expect them to have like giant fart clouds on stage now. The darts... people to be wafting the farts across the screen, so somebody's coming out in a gas mask the next time. Like, they're, you know, all this is going to do is make this crap more popular, right?
That's true. You know, as I say, it's who really is the loser here? Who really is the loser here? I think everybody's a winner.
So we tweeted out a little bit earlier on about Darren O'Dea reckons if Robbie Keane's prime was in the Ireland team, he wouldn't be able to score. Is he right? And then Mackie, at Mackie1981, goes, yeah, he's spot on. Comments from your panel, that's you mostly, and me and Phil, regarding the subject are clueless. You're like giddy little girls getting weak over Robbie. Ronaldo and Messi would struggle to score in the current setup. I think, Mr. Mackie1981, that if you had Ronaldo and Messi in the team at the moment, we'd be all right.
I think we'd be just fine.
I think that if you stuck Ronaldo and Messi in the Ireland team, we'd be grand.
Yeah. Maybe he's right. I don't know. Who are we to give an opinion? Who are we to give an opinion?
So a lot of people getting in touch complaining about the fact that we've spent so much time on a challenge match, a friendly and a Burn Cup game today. There's a lot of hating going on about the rugby team.
Well, the Burn Cup, I would say, is more important because there's actual silverware.
Exactly. I forgot that, yeah. And we still cherish Kildare's lone piece of national silverware at senior level when we won the Burn Cup under Geezer. It's a big, big moment.
Yeah.
Crowd on the pitch in Newbridge. It's a special day.
Imagine if it, like,
long in the annals of Kildare football history.
The only reason that game wasn't in the Aviva was because the Aviva wouldn't be able to contain the excitement of that particular occasion.
Which, sorry?
That O'Byrne Cup success for Kildare.
If it happened in the Aviva. Yeah. Boxcat Industries is on to say it's small potatoes compared to Ireland winning the Rugby World Cup 2 days ago. We're talking about the football match tonight. I predict there will be no other news until the next Grand Slam or the quarter final of the Rugby World Cup, whichever comes first. Boom. It's like, oh. It's mad how much joy people get in, like, deriding the rugby team. Like, there's like a real sense of pleasure that sports fans get from dumping on the rugby team.
Is that just not due to success? Like, you can talk about a cultural or social kind of view of the rugby team, or is it just from the idea that they've actually been extremely successful this year, and it leads to, I don't know, a bit of begrudgery? Because I would suggest that if Dublin, for example, lost an All-Ireland semi-final next year, there would be a hell of a lot of glee, similar to the glee that will come if Ireland lost another World Cup quarterfinal next year. Is it just mere begrudging towards success for a sport that you wouldn't necessarily watch that much?
Jealousy.
I wonder if that is, if it's just as simple as that, if you overcomplicate things when we talk about that why people don't like the rugby team.
There's people over there having a good time. I'm going to get those bastards.
Yeah.
That's the...
Well, yeah. I think it kind of... We are experiencing a similar sort of attitude towards Manchester United fans at the moment. People are like still laughing at them because of a downfall post Alex Ferguson.
I think it's different. I think that people didn't hate on Man United succeeding the way... I mean, they did, obviously, but only if you were... So, say you weren't a Liverpool fan, right? If you were a neutral and Man United played really well, you were kind of like, well, that was a very exciting team to watch. Like, Giggs, Scholes, Keane, Beckham is an amazing midfield. And then whatever partnership they had up front from the Cantona period to York and Cole was like, this is sensational. You have a different Man United team when you were an Arsenal fan that was really good later on with Wayne Rooney, the Rio Ferdinand team. They were brilliant teams playing brilliant, beautiful football. Like, the way Ireland played rugby against the All Blacks was like about as good as a sports team can be with their available talent. All of the criticisms that you could have levelled at the Irish rugby team about them being conservative or only having a specific set game plan. We were kicking the ball basically to Tommy Bowe on the wing and trying to win the World Cup that way. All of those mistakes that we made at that point have been rectified. Like, the defence is brilliant. The creativity is off the charts. The skill level when they're like, the ball breaks and Marmion scoops it up to somebody. Mm. Like, that Bundiaki's skill level, like, his passing off both hands, which is apparently a major issue, the tackle technique, every single thing that Ireland could have controlled and got better at, they did. And they did it in a way that was, like, excellent to watch. So hating on that is a bit weird.
Yeah, it is. But people are weird. It's hating on the pursuit of perfection. And that pursuit, I wouldn't say it's almost complete, but it's as close as I can ever remember any Irish sporting team being to kind of a perfect eyes of themselves, because it's certainly the best rugby team I've ever seen. Can't really remember too many other cases of near perfection. And maybe that's it. Maybe
Kilkenny hurlers and they beat Waterford in the final.
Yes. 2008 Kilkenny, this Ireland rugby team. Like, they are things that, I guess, did they leave yourself open to, I guess, as you put it, jealousy? I don't know. What are you jealous of?
People were complaining that Waterford didn't show up that day, and so therefore, blah, blah, blah. Like, well, maybe we should just enjoy the Kilkenny, their first wide in the 67th minute. Something ridiculous like that. Like,
yeah.
I don't know, but are we supposed to read some of these comments or not? I don't know. You want us to read them? Okay, okay, here we go. You're not allowed to enjoy this victory according to Ewan in Brazil. Hashtag OTBM, says Noel Cal on YouTube. It's funny how people are also obsessed with Ewan as well. It's like, he writes pieces. You can take them or leave them. That's your choice. But tagging him in tweets when, you know, like, I don't understand that. Scott Hamilton says, Irish were great. No New Zealanders bashing Ireland now. For now. For a few weeks. We have a few weeks of them. Slowly, they'll kind of reform like the Terminator 2 and come back at us with like, well, our players were tired. It's the end of a season. Let's get you early in the year and we'll see what happens. My highlight was Toner absolutely smashing Retallick, says Tony Kennedy. Big moment of the game. Set the tone. No pun intended. You did capitalise the T, so you did intend the pun. Connor Joyce says, classic Ireland after winning a game that has the same meaning of a Burn Cup match. This is a country that has never won a knockout game at the World Cup and won't change that next year either. How do you know, Connor? Like, the future is not yet written, but we can, you know, we can pretend that we know exactly what's going to happen in the future. I mean, if you think that's what's going to happen, then bet your house on it. If that's how confident you are. Kevin Q says, Connor, history is history. What has that got to do with what happens at the World Cup next year? This team is now capable of winning a World Cup in 2019. Here's the thing, 5 or 6 teams are capable of winning the World Cup, and it'd be stupid not to have that conversation. Like, in South Africa, they'll be having that conversation. In France, I think they'll be having that conversation. As wild as that might seem, their performances have improved vastly in the last 5-6 months. England are England, and will have an amazing array of players available to them, irrespective of the injury and profile that they have. Ireland have just beaten New Zealand. New Zealand, there's 5 teams, all of whom I think can realistically think. After that, it would take a bit of a miracle for any of the other teams, particularly Australia. The fact that we won despite Wayne Barnes awarding New Zealand a penalty for a phantom forward pass against us and we still won, that's the moment of the game. And we should have been a scrum for a forward pass. I think it was probably something else, was it? Stop taking the bait, lads. Joycey just trying to be controversial, says Barra de Royster.
Joyce. He's become Joycey within the YouTube comments. Yeah. They have nicknames for each other in the YouTube comments.
They're probably mates, right. Our house in the middle of our street. Come on over, Nathan. How are you?
How are you, lads? How's it going?
How are you?
Aarhus. Very well. Cold. A bit cold up here. Who could have predicted such a thing?
Is it like -5, -6? Cold?
No, it's like 5 degrees.
All right. Fine.
It's not going to be any lower than that either. So it's not going to be a factor. It's not going to be an excuse tonight.
Are you
for the Irish players literally freezing once again?
Is Aarhus not the other side of the bridge? So you haven't gone to Copenhagen by mistake or Malmo?
No. I'm 100% in real Denmark today. Aarhus is about 2 hours north of Copenhagen, so I think most of the Irish fans flew into Copenhagen and got the bus up. But I managed to get on the old Ryanair direct to Aarhus, where it was pretty subdued with the Irish fans. I think it's fair to say most of them are wondering, why the hell did we book this flight?
What are the Ireland fans looking forward to most about this evening?
Going to the pub, having a strong drink. I think the actual match itself is quite irrelevant to their humour. Even a big away win at this stage is probably going to be somewhat dented by the fact that Denmark are going to rotate their players. They're already promoted. They had a big win against Wales on Friday night. They're going to be without the suspended Kasper Schmeichel and Thomas Delaney. It does seem as though Christian Eriksen is actually going to play, so at least there is that. It adds a little bit of gravitas to this match. But everything out of Aga Harida at his press conference yesterday suggests that they may well make 5-6 changes to their team. So even if we do get that big win, what does it actually mean? I still think Martin O'Neill needs it, though. Obviously, with one win in the last year, just to get some sort of, it's not even momentum at this stage, but just some sort of positive feeling to bring them through the winter before the qualifiers start next March.
I mean, what do you expect from Ireland tonight in terms of how we're actually going to play football? Because we've been having this minor debate here about whether or not Robbie Keane would score goals in this team. And like, I don't know. I mean, you stick Robbie Keane in any team and he's going to be okay. But we don't have Robbie Keane and we haven't scored a goal in a long time in a meaningful game. So what the hell's going to happen?
I think it's going to be more of the same. I think this is going to be a 0-0 or a 1-0 either way, unless Denmark just go and batter us. I can't suddenly see a new style of play. I expect, even though a lot of the newspapers today feel that he may change to 4 at the back because he felt that 3 at the back were just too open in midfield right now. I think he'll go with 3 at the back again. But I think Robbie Keane, you're right, would score goals in any team. But you don't have Robbie Keane, so you have to find another way of scoring goals. And you need to figure out another system that at least allows you to create chances. That's been the biggest problem over the past year, is that we're not creating any chances. We're not laying siege on lesser opposition's goal. It's the odd set piece here and there. Shane Duffy right now is our best goal threat. It's as simple as that. He is our most likely outlet of getting a goal. I'd be interested to see what he does with those more attacking positions. Does he play Callum Robinson as the striker, or does he play Callum Robinson playing in just behind Aidan O'Brien? That's the only real option with Shane Long and Seanan Maguire out injured. Unless, and here, why not go for it? Why not start Michael Obafemi and something just happens? He gets a goal or two, and suddenly with this new superstar that gets us talking over the next 3 or 4 months and gets everybody excited about what might happen. Now, maybe it backfires and he doesn't do anything, but at this stage, if I'm Martin O'Neill, I'm thinking, what's the worst that can happen? This is as low as it has ever been for Irish football. So he just needs to do something. He needs to try and find some sort of a spark from somewhere.
What do you think the chances are of Martin O'Neill not being the Ireland manager when, so let's say the draw is made, right, and the draw is hard. Does that change anything?
No, I don't think so. I don't think the draw that we get for Euro 2020, if we end up with Germany and Spain or Germany and England or whatever it may be, is going to reflect how the FAI think. Like I say, what's there to lose? Maybe is there a huge amount to lose for Martin O'Neill tonight? If we go and get ripped apart again by Denmark and you end up losing this game 3 or 4-0, it's going to be very, very difficult for the FAI to justify keeping him on. And if people look at the money side of this, so say Wales and Denmark were decent opposition and they get a big crowd into the Aviva Stadium. You end up losing big tonight and are people going to come to the matches? Like, so suddenly if you're playing games in front of 25,000 people, how much money is that costing the FAI week in, week out? Suddenly it's got to even itself out, particularly with Euro 2020 being played in Dublin. I still think that the money can't be that much of an issue with the amount of money you're going to gain from actually qualifying from Euro 2020 with a manager who can somehow get the best out of these players. So it all depends on those finances. I think the Irish public have lost faith. I think this is the lowest ebb we've had, certainly I ever remember in Irish football. I know people can point to the Staunton era, but that was just down solely to the manager. We knew we had the players. Right now, I don't know if we know if we have the players or not, because the manager's not getting anywhere near the best out of them. And I think Daryl Lenihan's performance on Thursday night is probably a prime example. He had an absolute horror show. But you look at him and everything you've heard from inside the camp, and you wonder, like, did he find out an hour beforehand that he was going to be playing on the right side of a three? Had he practiced that all week in training? Or was he just thrown into the lines then? And you're so unsure of yourself. And these players don't seem to have any sort of the clarity of the rugby players have, where everything, they know exactly what's expected of them. And there's going to be a lot of those comparisons made, and it's going to drive Martin O'Neill absolutely demented. But it's not just the Irish football team. You look at Irish sport in general now. Our teams are excelling because they are in an elite environment. They demand the best of themselves. They're ultra prepared. They lack for nothing, all except the Irish football team, where it seems there's little or no preparation going on. They've been thrown out of the pitch, and it's fend for yourself, lads, which is unfair on the players as well. And I don't know, reading the reports from the press conference last night with Martin O'Neill, it felt as if there was a little bit of an edge regarding. So Seamus Coleman obviously is talking a lot about the style of football and trying to get it down, and the players needing to take more responsibility. O'Neill cutting across him and saying, everything here is my responsibility. Everything here, the style of play, all of that is on me. But the performance has just been absolutely dire. And it's getting worse, if that's possible.
Just on that point that you make about another manager coming in to get the best out of these players, and that would be the reason why the FAI would replace Martin O'Neill. Like, I wonder if, even if you got a manager in who got the best out of these players, that they would even qualify for the Euros because of the fact that we are third seeds, because of the fact that there's a chance that we could get Germany in our group, who will be second seeds in our group. That when Jura says that it might be a sensible move to actually replace the management after we see the draw, well, if you see two average enough teams as our one and two seed, particularly the two seed is an average enough team, and we feel with just a little bit of an overachievement, we might be able to nab second spot, well, that risk is probably worth taking. Whereas if second seed is Germany, you know, getting the most out of yourselves would probably mean finishing third.
See, I don't know, because actually you look at Irish football, there's no great pattern to when we perform. We can underperform against teams below us. We've beaten Germany at home in the last 3 years. So I don't think you can look at that. I just don't see how any of the other potential candidates could do any worse with this group right now. Yeah. The problem we have here is that for the first time, it feels in living memory, Irish players are playing worse for their country than they're playing for their club. They do not make the mistakes that they make in a green jersey when they're playing for their clubs, because football has moved on massively. With Jerry Taggart on the Keith Andrews show last Thursday, just the latest in a long line of former Leicester and Celtic players we've spoken to, who said he would run through a brick wall for Martin O'Neill. But still, it's 20 years ago. These players now, the likes of Robbie Brady, Jeff Hendrick, who've come through emerging talent programs, who've come through academy systems, they are drilled to within an inch of their life when they go onto a pitch. You watch Burnley play, can't say this enough. You watch Stephen Ward, and you watch Jeff Hendrick and Robbie Brady. They don't make mistakes. They look like they are well capable, and they are well capable, of playing Premier League football. So why do they make them when they're with Ireland? Because they don't know what they're meant to be doing. Because when Jeff Hendrick gets the ball for Ireland, he doesn't have four options. He looks up. They haven't practiced it on the training pitch. Whereas when he gets with Burnley, he knows exactly where the striker is going to be, the left back, the right back, the two wingers. They have done it in training again and again and again. Whereas everything we've seen and everything we've heard about this Irish camp is that doesn't happen.
I think we should probably start having the Stephen Kenny conversation in, like, you know, in all seriousness, where you could probably afford to pay off O'Neill and Keane and give Stephen Kenny the job. And irrespective of what happens, it would be the right thing to do, because you would hope that they would give Stephen Kenny a 4-year deal or two qualifying campaigns, technically probably a 3-year deal at this stage. And like, I mean, he obviously deserves to be paid the going rate for the job. It's just that we've massively overpaid our managers for the last while. So,
yeah, that's a weird conversation in that when, for some reason, when you talk with Stephen Kenny, it's like, well, you know, they could probably get Stephen Kenny for 300 grand a year. And that's not really fair in a way in that, as you say, he should be paid whatever the going rate is. But what is the going rate? Because Ryan Giggs gets 400 grand a year. So maybe 300 grand a year for the Republic of Ireland is that. But you're going to look at the last 10 years and say, well, wait a second. If I'm getting this gig, I should be getting £1 million a year. You know, the rewards are going to be the same if we qualify for Euro 2020 as if you were paying a manager £1 million. So maybe you just load it up with bonuses and if you do qualify, if you do deliver. But that's why I think actually now is the time, because like Brian Kerr, when he took over, that campaign, even though they nearly turned it around, was sort of gone before it even started his initial campaign for Euro 2004. Whereas he obviously had the full campaign for the World Cup and it didn't work out. If you get someone in now, they still have a reasonable amount of time. They're going to have 3-4 months to get their head together before the next qualifiers. And remember, and it's bloody complicated, but there is something slightly possibly at stake tonight, which is you can move up one in the rankings potentially by winning tonight's game, which means it gives you a slightly better chance of qualifying for the playoffs in March 2020 for the Nations League, which I still think is almost certain to happen, regardless of what we do in Euro 2020. It would take something pretty remarkable in the qualifying campaign that we don't end up in a 4-team playoff in March 2020 to qualify for the European Championship Finals. So give another manager that chance. Give him the time to actually bed in. Rather than what you're saying, we get Germany and we get to Germany first night out. We end up getting whipped again. And suddenly that campaign feels like it's gone. So yeah, I would be at this stage, I don't think Martin O'Neill has any real stock left with football supporters in this country. I think too much water's gone under the bridge. There have been too many poor nights. There's no sign of it getting any better. Yeah, we've had great moments. You can go back to Lille, you can go back to Vienna, but those performances aren't happening anymore. It is time for change. There's no question. I think everybody feels we just need something new, a fresh voice.
Can you just explain that again? Because the Nations League is not like riding a bike whatsoever. You completely forget the format every couple of weeks. So we finish bottom of this three-table group. We then need Wales and Denmark to qualify automatically. And then we get bumped into a playoff spot.
No. What Wales and Denmark do is completely irrelevant almost to what we do over the next months in terms of the 2020 qualifiers. There's 24 teams are going to qualify for Euro 2020. 20 of them will come from the qualifying campaign.
Yeah.
You would expect that of those 20 teams that qualify, looking at previous history, 17 or 18 of them at least are going to be from Leagues 1 and 2. Leagues A and B. Yeah. We're in League B. And then there's 4 teams from League A go to a playoff, 4 teams from League B. But that then feeds itself down. So basically, you'll have 8 teams more than likely available, because all the teams from League A should qualify. So that opens up spaces again and again, and it just feeds down a ladder system. So right now, I think we're 23rd, Northern Ireland are 24th. We could potentially go to 22nd. I still think 22nd, 23rd, 24th are all going to get through. It basically means we're looking at right now, I think, at 6 teams from League C and D would need to qualify for us not to get a playoff. And that is not going to happen.
Remember,
it's only 2 teams that qualify automatically. So do you look at the quality of teams in C and D? But you look at Serbia, potentially.
But hang on, I mean, in the past you would have written off Iceland, Northern Ireland, like you would have looked at groups
above us.
But in the past, the teams in those groups, you would have looked and gone, there's no chance of Iceland qualifying, there's no chance of Northern Ireland qualifying, all the way back, there's no chance of Greece qualifying, these aren't good teams. Like, international football's gone a bit weird, stuff happens, a victory tonight would be good. Like,
again, but I get what you're saying. These things do happen, but you're still looking at potentially 6 of those teams qualifying automatically from the top 2 positions. And if we win tonight, you might even be looking at 7 of those teams. That has never happened. Not that amount of teams. Now, there's no guarantee you go into that playoff. You could end up in a playoff with Iceland, with Northern Ireland. It's one game. It's not over 2 legs. You've got to go. You've got to deliver. But you would hope by then we're actually in a position where there's a little bit of confidence, there's a little bit of something there that you feel you can go and achieve something. But I do think that in all likelihood, whoever is in charge will get that opportunity in those playoffs.
All right.
You're excited, guys. I can tell. I can tell you're excited about this game.
Is there anything else to do in Aarhus other than go to watch Ireland against Denmark?
I have literally just landed in Aarhus in an airport around 50 minutes from Aarhus, it turns out. Not really, it seems. Not a huge amount. But I'm going to go and I'm going to wander the streets for the next 12 hours and see what I can come up with.
Well, enjoy that. So do you expect Obafemi to start or not? Like,
No, I don't expect him to start. They seemed pretty forceful last night about just throwing out caps. That it's not what we want to do. We don't want to end up in the position that we're just giving them just to tie them down. Martin O'Neill was pretty strong on that. Seamus Coleman was very much in agreement. I don't think he'll start. I think he'll go with Callum Robinson. I think he'll stay with it. Again, it's a Martin O'Neill team. You could get the 11 and look at it and go, what the hell is going on here? I think the back three will be Keogh, Duffy and Long, Coleman and Brady as the wing backs, probably Cyrus Christie in midfield once again alongside Harry Arter. And from there on, I'm not quite sure what it's going to be, where Callum Robinson is. Does he go with Aidan O'Brien and give him another opportunity? Like, Aidan O'Brien isn't scoring any goals at club level at this stage. Callum O'Dowda, did he do enough in the 45 minutes against Northern Ireland to keep his place? Does have a lot of time for Callum O'Dowda, but it's not particularly inspiring, let's be honest.
All right. On that cheery note, Nathan.
Woohoo!
Talk to you later.
See you, lads.
Said Nathan Murphy there in Aarhus, in Denmark.
Yeah, well,
as low as it's ever been. Like,
well, my hopes are up because I did forget about that fact that we are still within a division that most people will qualify automatically for the Euros, and that basically that is the beauty of being a top two division team in the Nations League, that all you got to do is really not be the shittest team, just be the second shittest team and you'll probably qualify for a playoff.
So when do we get relegated?
What do you mean, when do we get relegated?
Into the not top two divisions.
Like next time. Next time we're in Division 3.
Even if we
win, we're definitely finishing bottom of this.
And if we win and
but if we win, we will sit on 3 points. So we will be better off than the other crap teams lying at the basement there and that are about to get relegated. And therefore, above them on the pecking order when the ladder comes down to us to be a playoff team.
Right.
So I'm actually kind of just disappointed in myself that I didn't remember that particular rule from the Nations League.
Yeah, I know, because the Nations League was your specialist subject.
It's the only reason I'm on this show.
It's
so
almost like you couldn't make any new memories, that your brain is so blitzed from.
It's almost as if the Nations League has been nothing to bring any memories with.
How was Saturday night? You were in the front row for Kevin Kilbane.
Well, Saturday night I was watching the All Blacks against Ireland.
Yeah.
Friday night Kevin Kilbane was playing.
Friday night, yeah, okay.
He was excellent. I think it's coming tonight actually on DIB Stuff Australia YouTube. Or maybe not. I don't know. It's definitely coming at some point soon. He was really good.
Yeah, what was he playing?
He was playing house music.
Yeah.
He was there.
Where did you end up afterwards?
I just kind of milled around for a while, left relatively early afterwards. Things were getting intense enough after that. He actually, Kevin got us up on stage with Groove Armada at one point.
Oh, what?
So we were there up on stage and like they were like right there DJing and like there was a big crowd there. We were just standing around. It was like, well, this is kind of cool.
Oh, right. You were dancing.
Well, yeah. We weren't too out of place. We probably were. But yeah, he was.
Why are there a bunch of cops on the stage?
look at all our uncles up on the stage. Even I felt actually quite old. So yeah, that was that. But he was very impressive. I was actually very highly impressed.
And did people recognize him, or did like a bunch?
Yeah, that was actually probably the best part, where you kind of looked around the room and they were just like lads walking. They were like, "Oh my god, I recognize that guy. That's the guy who used to play for Ireland like decades ago." But to us, obviously, we kind of the surprise wasn't there for us. But it was great. He did really well, so it'll be a good documentary series.
Yeah, looking forward to that. It's Baltic here too. Hope you have the long johns. Says Jason, is one of the Ireland fans in Aarhus. There are some there. And then the other tweet that I need to bring you right now is Barry Finnegan says, "Big debate on athletes farting at the hockey at Off the Ball AM. Worth the listen back." Thanks, Barry.
Can it be constituted as a debate? It just kind of like fits. You're kind of like the rugby haters this morning. You just hate darts. And when you saw an opportunity to go in two-footed on darts this morning, you absolutely went for it. So I think that's absolutely sickening on your part.
There you go. Opportunistic in the extreme. So a couple of quick things. A reminder, of course, O2BAM is live with Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products. Are we going to do our breakfast menu? No? Yeah, okay. Quickly, Big Number One, New Zealand Humility, Republic of Ireland Awards, Napiershiger out, and Dub Hurlers return. News coming through that a bunch of the Dublin Hurlers who haven't been part of the setup for the last couple of years are coming back. At big news this morning. We'll get to the details of that. Big Number One, New Zealand Humility. New Zealand have been pretty humble in defeat. It's been interesting. They were good losers for a group of people who aren't particularly practiced at it. The other one that we wanted to talk about was Dan McDonald's brilliant piece today, where
this is a very important angle.
He's concerned.
Like, we've been speaking about ways of caring about this game tonight in Denmark, and there's clearly one angle that has been found, and it'll make you salivate at the prospect of this game, because spare a moment for those people who run the FAI awards, basically, is what Dan McDonald is saying. It's time to spare a thought for the organisers, he says. Tradition dictates that the gongs are handed out before the first game of the following year. The event is sold as a celebration. As it stands, the Abbottstown planners are going to be presented with some difficulty. On the basis of the 8 matches so far, the outstanding candidate for Player of the Year and the young player is probably Declan Rice. Not ideal. Although, could be a good move. It's like, hey Declan, it's us in the FAI here. You've won Young Player of the Year and Player of the Year. The last person to do anything of the sort was Tony Kelly in GAA. It's also a great come here and come and play some hurling with us as well, and put back on that Ireland jersey.
Jack Grealish won Young Player of the Year one time.
He did. Cyrus Christie won Young Player of the Year last year.
27.
Basically. He also talks about the goal of the year is in danger of being sued for false advertising. The forerunner field at the moment, four goals, consists of a Sean Williams dink following an Aaron Ramsey brain freeze, a one-yard effort from Graham Burke, an Aidan O'Brien header in Poland, for me, goal of the year, and Alan Judge's injury time strike against the USA, which was again kicked off by Rice invention. So really, Ireland need to produce a worthy man of the match performance tonight that will result in that person becoming player of the year, and a goal that's quite good to win goal of the year. And
it doesn't have to be quite good. It has to be mediocre.
It has to be mediocre.
Intentional.
Intentional will be good. And then the FAI awards have been saved. So that's the big thing at stake tonight. So thanks to Dan for pointing that out. You mentioned, we've kind of gone through all the rugby there. We mentioned the Piercing as well, getting knocked out. Ballygunner beating them in the Munster final. The fairy tale year for Limerick comes to an end.
You got the Herald there?
The Herald is going through the hurling story where Mark Schutte is among the names returning to the Dublin panel. You've got it here. It's been reported here by Conor McKeown that he is going to go back in with the hurlers. Of course, Jim Gavin brought him into the Dublin camp last summer, summer 2017. Played a couple of minutes here and there, but he'd certainly be of higher value to the Dublin hurlers. So Matty Kenny, of course, he would have worked with Mark Schutte before club level, getting a pretty good start to the proceedings in Dublin hurling, because do you suddenly then, if they have all the resources available to them, do you put Dublin into that mix of this epic All-Ireland Hurling Championship awaiting us next summer? It does seem that it's like
certainly
7-1 and then the rest.
Leinster becomes a bit better. The depth in Leinster would be great.
Leinster Championship this year was pretty good.
Well, the fact that Wexford have suddenly become a team that you can trust to perform to a consistent level over the last couple of years has been brilliant. And obviously 60,000 at the Leinster hurling final was ridiculous a couple of years back. So Dara O'Connell and Sean Tracy apparently are also going back after a year and two away respectively, so add that into Mark Schutte, and all they need now is Conor Callaghan, and suddenly there's like a lot of excitement around the Dublin Hurlers.
Does Dermot Connolly's link, does that intensify?
I don't think so, now that Pacquiao's gone.
Yeah, true. Like, if they got Conn, obviously, you'd put them right into that rung, but that's not going to happen. Like, who would leave a team that's going for five in a row, especially when you've been, like, a starter and a stalwart in that team?
Well, when they win five in a row, it's not enough. There are no other kingdoms for them to conquer.
Six
at that point,
in a row.
They all become, why bother? At that point, it's like just numbers. They can all retire.
Well,
we start again.
Insurmountable lead that six or seven in a row would bring.
Tributes for Uisce Fogarty in all the newspapers this morning, and of course on radio and social media over the week. You found the photograph the first time you met Uisce.
Yeah, my mother actually digged it out yesterday. It was, I can't remember if it was before the first game or the replay against Armagh 2000 in the All-Ireland semi-final. I think that's the first time I met Uisce. I'd love to actually know where that is. It's somewhere in Dublin. But yeah, the night before the game, always a gentleman. Like, he was, I was saying that you kind of never knew a time when you didn't know who Uisce Fogarty was. It's just kind of part of everybody's lives, and it's just such a vital cog in all those great memories, and from 97 particularly onwards. And for like what a loss he is. He was such a gentleman. Like, we've dealt with him a few times here. We can't claim to have ever been a friend of Uisce or anything. We didn't know him that well, but every time you did deal with him, it felt like he was a friend of yours, because he just had such a great way about him, such great generosity, such a heart of gold. And of course, as a professional, you don't need me to describe what he did. You all need to do is just listen back to some of his stuff yourself. And what a genius, really.
Yeah, great company. Spent a good long chat with him at the PPIs 1 year, and just like genuinely a lover of sport. Didn't become a broadcaster until he was about 55.
Yeah.
That was what Malky Clerkin was saying in his piece yesterday, or in a piece that was doing the rounds, but also on Twitter, he pointed out that he'd been an All-Ireland winner as a footballer at senior level, which I hadn't realised, and a referee. He dished out the first ever yellow card in Gaelic Games history, so that's pretty impressive.
That is a great stat.
Also, I had served with Killarney Legion at every level as player, administrator, and all the team mentor and all that kind of stuff as well. So he died at the age of 77 after an illness. Injury cut short his playing career, became a respected referee, three successive All-Ireland football semis in 81, 82 and 83. Obviously, it doesn't help that he's from Kerry in the peak of the boom years, and he's a referee trying to get an All-Ireland final, and bloody hell, Kerry keep qualifying for it every year. So that obviously didn't help. He did referee the under 21 All-Ireland football final in 1980. So, we're going to play out with this today. It's a piece that you can find across all of Off the Ball's channels. In summer 2015, Joe went down and did the paper review and presented the entire show from Killarney. And so, before they get into all the stuff from the day in the game, Rishi wanders up and sits down and they have a chat. And it's a bit of glorious radio. Have a listen.
Pretty spectacular. Oh. What mountains am I looking at?
Wow, they're way over to your right, Joe. Way like this, stream right over is Carntool, the highest mountain in Kerry. And coming along then you have the McGillicuddy Reeks all in front of you, all running along in front of you over there. And away over to the left then you have around Rathmore direction, you can see out to Rathmore called the Paps. So the McGillicuddy Reeks and Carntool all over, stretching away over there. Looking at the town then, you might want to know what you see in front. Yeah. What a spectacular view of greenery. Over to your right is the tall steeple of St. Mary's Cathedral. That's the cathedral that I was married in. That's the cathedral I was baptised in. That's the cathedral that I'll be taken to when I die. Directly in front of you then is the Protestant, St. Mary's Protestant Church. That's the other steeple in the middle. And then to your left is the friary, the Franciscan friary. That's the other steeple you see to your left. I was at 10 o'clock mass there this morning and the priest was welcoming everybody to the Munster final. and you can see Killarney then just in front of you there, and all those houses you see just there, there were some great footballers came out of there between the Dr. Crokes and the Legion Club.
OTB AM.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.